Coming up next on Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, we talk about QuakeCon, North America's largest LAN party, coming up this weekend. We also have AMD APUs working with discrete GPUs, and is Intel really considering using the Mantle API? It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 275, recorded on July 10th, 2014. Is Intel showing interest in Mantle? This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by iFixit. You can fix it, and iFixit makes it easy with step-by-step repair guides, high-quality replacement parts, and all the tools you'll need. For $10 off your purchase of $50 or more, go to iFixit.com/twit and enter the code TWITCH at checkout. Hey everybody, welcome to This Week in Computer Hardware, Twit's weekly show that aims to bring you the best news in PC hardware. We seem to be having this back and forth thing where I think Patrick and I are having another like domestic dispute where we don't want to be on the show at the same time.
A spat, if you will.
Yeah, last week I wasn't on the show at all and I made him do it by himself. The week before that, he wasn't on it and we brought in Robert. And this time I was tired of him again, so we brought in Josh.
Hi.
Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for joining me. Yeah, I mean, you know, I get to talk to you two nights in a row. It's like the highlight of my week, really, because now we don't have any of those other people.
I just want to scratch your ears out twice as much.
Exactly. So let's get into stuff that is happening this week. First up, kind of more on a personal note, Josh and I will both be in Dallas, Texas at this time next week. We will be at QuakeCon. As he's wearing his shirt, I'm wearing the very first workshop shirt we did. This is from 2009, actually. And QuakeCon is North America's largest LAN party, still, I believe. And it's held in Dallas at the Hilton Anatole Convention Center. And since 2009, we have hosted a workshop, which is essentially really just an excuse to give away a ton of stuff. Right. We get up on stage. I get a 2-hour block of time on the main stage. We get like 2,000 of our closest friends sitting in chairs, screaming at us and raising their hands as we attempt to pass out products this year. If you look at that list. Yeah, I know. And oh, yeah. Shirts. Lots of shirts.
Shirts.
Well, let's give away lots of shirts. People love T-shirts. They love free T-shirts. It's the weirdest thing. If you look at the list.
My dresser is entirely full of them.
Of free T-shirts. You know, my wife. Inevitably at the end of each QuakeCon, we'll have like 3 or 4 extra shirts that will just come. They'll come back in the truck with me and I'll put them in like the closet. She's like, why do you have 5 of the same T-shirt? It's like, I just don't want to get rid of it. It's just a T-shirt. Just leave it there. I think she goes behind my back and empties out my closet of T-shirts when I'm not paying attention. So hey, if I don't notice, that's fine. But if you look at the list of prizes, I mean, we have, you know, stuff from AMD, Bitphoenix, Corsair, EVGA, Galaxy, Fractal Design, like tons of companies. If you just scroll down the list, we've got thousands and thousands of dollars worth of hardware that we're going to give away if you are able to come to the PC Perspective Hardware Workshop. And you don't have to pay to get to it. It is a free event. All you have to do is show up and register for QuakeCon. And then you can come to the workshop itself, which is Saturday, July 19th at noon Central Time, noon local time. There'll be a big lineup before that. So if you want to get seats in the front, you got to get to the front of that early. But we'll be giving away a bunch of stuff. And Josh, you'll be glad to know that this time we figured out a way to get around using the paper tickets.
Enlighten me.
Well, it's a super secret thing. I'm not gonna broadcast it until right before we get to do the workshop because I don't want anybody to ruin it. But we're not going to have to worry about the paper tickets anymore.
That's nice. So you don't have the paper ticket stapling monkeys in the conference room?
We will not have to have people stapling 2,000 tickets to 2,000 sheets of paper before the workshop. So check that out if you can. If you happen to be in the area, we would love to see you. If you see either of us or anybody on the PC Per team, feel free to come up.
Do you have any idea what Tap will be doing this year?
No, he doesn't either. No, that's we have good. No idea. We never know what he's going to talk about until probably maybe the night before, more than likely the morning of. Nice. So it'll be it'll be interesting. If you want to attend QuakeCon, the last thing I'll mention about this is that we actually have two BYOC spots up for grabs. If you go to PCPro.com and look for the post titled Win BYOC Seat at QuakeCon 2014, very descriptive, I think, you will find a little form you can fill out, just your name and your email. We're going to draw it on Friday. So if you're listening to this in the recorded version of Twitch, you will want to make sure you do this right away. Otherwise, we may have already picked a winner. If you live in the Dallas area or you're willing to actually attend QuakeCon, that's the only way I want you to enter. Otherwise, you're just going to win something that you can't use and you're going to make a bunch of people very sad. But we'll have two BYOC spots so you can bring your computer. You can spend all day Thursday, Friday, and Saturday gaming your hearts out if you want. And then obviously this will help you attend our hardware workshop, which is really, I think, the highlight of the weekend. I think that is really what people come for. If it weren't for us, I don't think
anybody could show up.
That's always pretty funny too. Yeah. It always helps when you show up having had a few beers and sit in the back and heckle everybody. Let's talk about hardware now instead.
Okay.
So AMD Mantle, it is a proprietary, for now, API for AMD hardware. We've talked about it a lot on the show and what it offers and what it complicates and how DirectX interferes, or not interferes, but interacts with it or compares to it. Well, as it turns out, based on this story that Scott posted for us this week, Intel has actually approached AMD about its interest in the Mantle API. They actually, Intel confirmed this with, I guess, a story over at PC World. The discussion was clearly labeled as an experiment by an Intel spokesperson that was initiated by them, not AMD. And according to AMD's gaming scientist, Richard Huddy, which we had an interview of here at the PC Perspective office, the response was essentially, give us a month or two, and once we get it into like the 1.0 phase, then it will become a public SDK and everybody will have access to use it and build drivers based on it. So I'm curious, Josh, what is your take on why would Intel do this, right? What do they have to gain for looking at something like Mantle as opposed to, you know, using the DirectX and OpenGL that we have known for a very long time?
You know, they could potentially get a couple of nice gains. The first would be in the mobile space, they could potentially get better battery life and efficiency because the CPU is not going to have to work harder to get these games on screen. And so battery life will be extended for such a thing. So, I mean, that's kind of a big positive, especially as Intel really is pushing for mobile, tablets, cell phones, whatever. And, you know, that would be kind of a big win if there were games on the mobile space that actually utilized Mantle. Another potential gain for them would be just getting their driver teams used to working with an API like that, because eventually DirectX, come late 2015, will be very, very similar in how it operates. And OpenGL is also heading in that direction as well. So they can get their hands on working software, get their driver teams used to what they see there. It would be kind of a big plus for them. I mean, depending on the workload that these software guys and compiler guys are under. So it's going to be interesting. You know, really, we've seen Intel shift direction in the past 2 years. Especially once, what was the last guy? Ottolini? Once he got out, the new fella seems to be more comfortable exploring other options instead of, like we were talking about last night, they've always kind of had a not invented here mentality. Certainly, they've changed their minds at times. I mean, x86 64 was AMD 64. I mean, their Intel's EPYC 64 architecture just wasn't up to snuff and was not very popular and was hard to code for because, you know, all of the work really had to be on the software developer and the compiler guys, and it just didn't work out real well. But it seems lately with them opening up their fabs, they're more open to licensing technology from other guys that will accentuate their products. rather than just saying, hey, we've got lots of engineers, we're going to throw them at this problem. It's like, hey, you know what? We could probably save some money, have something off the shelf, and license it. I mean, they're another story later on we'll talk about is there, again, with the foundry opening up to other clients. So in between all of that, I think it's I don't think it's a certainty that Intel will take up mantle, so to speak. But it would be well worth their time to at least get their hands on the API and take a look at it. We may never see a driver that will support Mantle from Intel, right, but you know that their software guys are going to be taking it apart and taking a look at it.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I also don't think we'll actually see a driver from them, but anything that kind of helps them find a direction and maybe, like you said, kind of get a head start on what DX12 will be like, I think would be good for them. And they of all of the companies, you know, that are making kind of desktop style GPUs, they could see just as much benefit as AMD from, you know, improving the performance of these integrated parts, really. So,
yeah.
Another story that went up this week, we looked at an open air test bench from Puget Systems. Puget Systems, you guys may know as a system builder from like the Pacific Northwest. They build really high quality machines. They build a lot of expensive like workstation class machines. They build very like, they were the first ones really to send us a machine that was targeted at silent activity. They happened to put something together that apparently they were building for their own uses internally for testing new components that they might put into systems. And they thought, well, we might as well make a few more of them and sell them and see if people like them. So this is the Puget Systems Test Bench EATX version 1. You can see here in the video we're showing that like it is a put it together yourself. It's a fairly thick acrylic. Almost all of it is acrylic. You've got like a foam pad and like a metal bracket that your GPUs and your expansion cards would actually install to, which is nice. But it's an open air case, essentially. It is a case where all of your components are exposed. If you've never used one of these, like it's useful for people that do like extreme overclocking and want to have hands-on with the motherboard and the processor and the cooling directly. It's useful for people that switch out components a ton, which is the category that I fall into, right? So if this is going on a GPU test bed or a CPU test bed, we're constantly swapping out parts. So it's important for us to have easy access to that whenever possible. And the third might be like, if you just want to show off all the parts you have, if you have an expensive system or you've got fancy lights or custom cool graphics cards, then, you know, having that is interesting as well. What you should not have if you buy one of these cases is like curious kittens that might walk up on your desk and maybe stick their paw on a moving fan, or as Alan suggested last night, lick your motherboard and either catch themselves a little shock or
isn't that a fetish? Haven't you?
Probably it is. Oh it, yeah, it's like licking the 9-volt battery, right? It's,
yeah,
which of these like pins on the motherboard can I lick at this? Yes, exactly, with that cat. It's a little expensive. It's $170 or so for this, which, you know, if you just take it at that, right, the fact that it is not a enclosed case and what you can get for $170 in the, you know, the standard ATX case world, it's definitely expensive. But you can find, there are a lot of other open air designs that are of similar expense. So, you know, this has some interesting features. I love the acrylic look to it. If you have LEDs that you can like LED strips, you want to run like underneath the motherboard, I'm sure that would create like a really cool lighting effect. It has support for all-in-one processor or CPU coolers, right? So if you look at, like, we have a Corsair H80i installed on this that mounts to this kind of back rear 120 millimeter processor mount. And actually it can support a 240 if you actually just point it up, right? So the top 120 would actually be connected to nothing and the bottom 120 of it would be connected into that case there. It's a very high quality build. Like, once I had it all together, it's very stable. It's not shaking. It's not kind of rickety feeling. Some of the other open air cases that we've used as test platforms before, you know, had screws that weren't properly threaded into things. And this is actually really, really nice. It supports, as the name suggests, extended ATX motherboards. So if you want to have that, you can do that as well. It does support three GPU configurations, but not four-way GPU configurations. Go read the or watch the video that we posted of it. I really do like it a lot, and I think it's I don't know if I would recommend a whole lot of people pay that much for an open air case like this, but for the specific use cases that like Josh and I have, where we are testing components on a regular basis and swapping things out, I think this type of thing makes a lot of sense. If I need to change the power supply out, I can do that real quick. If I need to add another GPU in or swap it out, I can do that real quick. If I need to look at the debug LED on the motherboard, I can do that real quick as well. So there's a lot of designs out there for this, but this is pretty cool. It was an interesting thing to get in and play around with. And you can see much of that video is actually me putting it together. And I think the most annoying part for me is, Josh, you know that like when you get an acrylic like that, and it has that paper that you have to peel off.
Yeah, I was going to ask, was it satisfying to peel that off or annoying?
I will say that of all these types of things that I have done, it came off the easiest on this than on almost any other, unit device I have done. Like it was a little bit annoying. I'm not going to go as far up as satisfying, but it wasn't as annoying as some of the other open air test cases we've had where I'm sitting there with my fingernails, start trying to get it started, pull it a little bit and it rips and you got to start it again. That would have been much more annoying.
Yeah, just be sure to clean that with alcohol or something like that, right?
I don't
make that acrylic cloudy.
Oh, yeah. Get it all. Yeah. Ruin it immediately upon getting all that gunky stuff off with isopropyl on it. You wrote a story this week as well that I thought was interesting about using an AMD APU while using a discrete GPU. In this case, you were actually using an NVIDIA GPU. And we're not specifically for gaming purposes, but for other compute capabilities, maybe pointing towards the future. What's kind of your summary out of this?
Since Kaveri has been released, I was very, very curious about if you could effectively run the GPU portion of the APU at the same time as having a standalone graphics card in there. In this case, I used the NVIDIA GTX 580. And as long as I kept, the drivers for the AMD part, the graphics part on there, I was able to access it. So I used Luxmark, which has pretty robust OpenCL support. And I was able to see not just, the OpenCL support of the APU, which is, the four cores of the SteamRoller processor, but I could also see the graphics portion of the APU and then the GTX 580. And you can use all of those together in conjunction when running this program through OpenCL. It compiles kernel and it encompasses all of those things. And I was able to see some decent gains from just, CPU only, CPU, GPU, and then, just the Spectre, which is kind of an interesting name. That was an old 3DFX name for a product many, many years ago that was never released. We were able to see, pretty good jumps in performance by enabling each part, except, of course, at the end when everything is enabled, we didn't get nearly the jump as, say, like using the GTX 580 and then adding in the Spectre. So if you add up those numbers, it's actually more than the sum of their parts, which is kind of interesting. Mm. But anyway, things worked out nicely. It worked fine. Power draw wasn't extreme. And I had no driver crashes. Games ran off of the GTX 580 without a problem. And you still have that potential muscle on the APU just kind of waiting there for software that can actually take advantage of it. And I think if you actually go to my article, some guy has listed out all of the current OpenCL applications which are supported by the APU. And there may be a couple of HSA things in there. I think the only HSA-enabled product is one of those open office, not open office, but LibreOffice. I think we saw that at CES when they had a certain type of spreadsheet thing that took advantage of that, if I remember correctly. So yeah, it's a nice thing. The potential for it is pretty good. I think Scott Michaud was talking about it and saying things like, you know, AI pathing and just AI in general and audio. These are things that could be loaded on the GPU portion of the APU. Those eight, what are they? What does AMD call them? They're just compute cores.
Compute cores, yeah.
Yes. And so you could effectively run these on those. You'd still have the quad core CPU doing a lot of the other work, and then you've got just your graphics card doing what it does best, is just, you know, render graphics.
The problem is, this is great and all, except it's all kind of theoretical.
It
still.
Is theoretical because we right? just
like,
don't
a
have
lot of
software.
A lot of moving parts have to come together to make that work, and a lot of companies have to. Like either work together, or I guess any company could really just write an application that just completely uses OpenCL and is able to do that. But right now, we're kind of limited to the benchmarks.
Yeah, pretty much. But again, you know, go to the go look on the comments. A guy wrote all kinds of stuff. I mean, a lot of the Adobe products actually utilize OpenCL. I think, except for what the newest one that they signed the Devil's Pact with NVIDIA.
Oh, right.
You know, Quadro stuff. But it's this would be kind of a nice thing. See, there's the list right there. Hey, Corel. All kinds of stuff in there. Cybermedia.
Corel's still around. All right. Good for them.
They are. Now, what the heck was I just about to say? This would be a good thing for AMD's version of GameWorks.
That's
what
true.
What is that called? I can't remember.
Well, they don't really have a name for it. I think it was called OpenWorks or something like that. That was their working title.
Yeah, I mean, this would be a fantastic thing for them to leverage with that software. And since they're developing themselves, and it'll be open source as far as I understand, hopefully we'll see them kind of head in that direction. And people who have bought these APUs for gaming machines and whatnot may get, you know, a performance and feature jump. And, right. You know, one other question and something that we didn't really cover last night is the new Kaveri APUs have true audio support in them. Mm-hmm. And as long as you have that driver installed and it enabled, apparently true audio will work. So you'll have a NVIDIA card in there and you can run it in Thief or that Lichdom.
Even if you're using an external GPU that doesn't have true audio. That's what you're
correct.
Saying.
Correct. That you gotcha. Will still be able to utilize that true audio capability in the Kaveri APU, which
that's pretty
why
cool.
isn't their marketing telling us about this stuff? Anyway, but yeah, it's a neat thing. Hopefully we can expand upon it more as more software becomes available.
Very cool. What else came out this week? Alan posted a review of a new Western Digital MyCloud Mirror. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this. It is a 2-drive network attached storage device that kind of follows up with their original release MyCloud, which I think came out in like last October, I guess it was. The idea is, which I think several other companies are trying to do, the idea is make a cloud-based storage system, but make it local for you where you have kind of all that control over it, right? So this is available in 2, 4, and 6 terabyte versions where you have 2 2-terabytes, 2 3-terabytes, or 2 4-terabyte drives. So you've got 2, 6, or 8 terabytes of drive in there, but because you're mirroring it, hopefully because you're not a crazy person, you're only getting, you know, half the capacity of what you have in drive space. But the idea is use it as your network attached storage device. It's your backup device. But it also has, really, really good functionality through Windows software and through mobile software for it to kind of act like a Dropbox style software package, like a Dropbox style service. And so if you have a computer at your office and your Western Digital MyCloud is at the house, you can install a piece of software on your office computer and it will show up as a network attached drive, right? And so you can access it that way. Now, obviously, you're limited by the upstream, downstream bandwidth of both locations, but you have access to it as if it were just there at your house, which is nice, or at your office in that case. So the Windows integration is really nice. If you don't want to use any of the extra features, Alan was talking about the setup with it is super simple. You know, you plug it in, and you plug in an Ethernet jack, you plug in a power jack, and you go to a Windows machine, it just shows up under the networking options. When you want to get into the additional features, the auto backup stuff, that's when you go into the dashboard that has a web-based interface, and then obviously it has the application-based interface. And then it has pretty good mobile software for both iOS and Android that Alan basically said acts just like Dropbox app does on iOS or Android, where you have the ability to view files, stream files, cache files, copy files to those devices from your mobile device. So it's a pretty interesting little product. You can, let's see, they do not sell it without drives in it. You have to buy it with hard drives. So you've got like $350 for the 4 terabyte, $450 for the 6 terabyte, and $530 for the 8 terabyte versions. Now that's, again, total capacity. So you cut that half of what you would have when you actually mirror it. But if you don't have something like this, if you don't have a network attached storage, like I was surprised by how handy this has become for us. Even at my house where it's just my wife and I, we had that issue where she was taking tons of pictures on her phone and with her camera and was saving it on her laptop. I was taking pictures on my phone and my camera and saving it on my computer. And we wanted to share them. And then at one point she had lost a hard drive and was worried about losing pictures. So we ended up getting a network attached storage device.
How do you lose a hard drive?
Well, maybe it dies, not lose.
Okay. Okay.
Not physically misplace.
Well, you never can
lose,
tell. Have you
lose
met
to
my
the
wife?
Gods. Well, I mean, I could do it. I got lots of hard drives I could throw out in the grass and see what happens. Yeah. But we get a network attached storage device and, you know, set it up so that her computer and my computer both kind of save in the same place. It's easier and as well as it's kind of a nice backup location. So obviously you need to back it up more than just those places, but interesting to see. So check out that review if you're interested in updating a NAS or getting a NAS device.
Hey, Ryan.
The other story. Yeah.
I've got to ask you this.
Okay.
When Alan comes in, do both of you guys kind of sit up and say, Alan? Alan?
No.
No?
No. No. Really? Usually when he comes in, I turn away into the corner and ignore him as long as I can until we have to speak. That's our working relationship. He's very healthy.
He's already got his head down in his phone. So, I mean, you don't. He's not going to look at you anyway.
Yeah, it's true. It happens. Let's get to another story that you kind of alluded to before. The Panasonic relationship with Intel is interesting in that it looks like Intel will be making actual ARM SoCs for Panasonic. Is that right?
That seems to be correct. And not only that, but they're going to be utilizing the 14-nanometer Tri-Gate process technology, which, that's exceptionally cutting edge, and nobody else has access to it except Intel. In fact, they have yet to release any 14-nanometer parts, even though we were supposed to see some already. Those have kind of been pushed off till next year because, you know what? Process technology is hard.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so yeah, Panasonic will be producing stuff through Intel, and that's kind of a win-win for both. Intel has had problems lately having their fabs run at 100%, and if you're not running a fab 24/7, you're kind of losing some money. So that they want to keep things filled up, which is why they've partnered with Altera. Typically, they partner with guys that they do not directly compete with. Now, in this case, with Panasonic, there probably has never been an Intel chip in any Panasonic product ever. Panasonic tends right. to build a lot of their own stuff and then source it from themselves. So, I mean, you get some interesting fluctuations in quality, but they, as far as I know, I mean, they don't go outside except for like, you know, TI with, you know, op amps and amplifiers and stuff. But with some of the control logic for apparently set-top boxes, again, they probably were never going to use Intel, and Intel knew that, but they were willing to come to Intel and say, hey, we'd like to rent out your fab, and Intel crunches them on numbers and says, yeah, we could probably do that because we need to fill out this fab space.
Yeah, I still find it, it's becoming, it used to be very, very surprising whenever a news story like this came out, and it just keeps creeping a little bit further down the line for what Intel is kind of willing to do to, you know.
To make almost, a buck?
Do you ever feel that Intel will separate its fab from its production like AMD did, or its fab from its design like AMD did, or is that just
no way
going to happen?
I think really their process technology helps to drive their advantages in the marketplace. I mean, they've got, hands down, some of the best fabs in the known universe, and they have more fab space than pretty much anybody else. I mean, TSMC is probably approaching them, but that's because they've got something like 12 fabs. So, yeah, it's not a surprise that this is happening, and no, I don't think they're going to spin it off again. I mean, why would they? If you spin off your fabrication, guys, it's going to do the same thing GlobalFoundry does, which is, you know, we've got to manage our costs. We may not be as cutting edge as we want to be just because we're managing costs, and this is what we do. But at the same time, you know, the processor guys at Intel, they're making these designs like, you guys need to, you know, push forward. And the process guys are like, no, we don't take orders from you anymore. And our accountants say that we need to do this. And so, you know, we're going to have 6 more months before you can have access to this brand new process. And I don't see Intel doing that anytime soon until we get to, you know, like maybe 5 nanometer type stuff, where it may not really go much further with current technology. I don't know.
Science will save us. It's fine.
Yes.
I'm not even worried. This is a face that's not even worried about 5 nanometer, clearly. We've been moving along here. Let's go ahead and actually get into our sponsor for this week's episode. I want to make sure we get a chance to talk about iFixit.com, who is helping bring This Week in Computer Hardware to you guys. iFixit.com is the free online repair manual for everything. They have more than 10,000 repair guides for everything from electronics like your smartphone, tablet, game console, even to your home appliances, clothing apparently, and even your good old bicycle, Josh. They also have foolproof instructions to fix all of your stuff. If you've shattered your iPhone screen, for example, if you need to repair the red ring of death on your Xbox 360 so you can finish that last handful of games that's coming out on that system, or if you need to swap the battery on your Galaxy S3, iFixit has got you covered with parts, tools, and repair guides. iFixit also makes the most trusted repair tools for consumer electronics, including the ProTech Toolkit. The ProTech Toolkit is something that we have 2 of here in our office because it gets a lot of use. It has 70 tools to assist you with any mod, malfunction, misfortune that comes your way. Toolkit is the gold standard for electronics work, for garage, from garage hackers to apparently the CIA and FBI. But more importantly, their unique tools are used by repair technicians everywhere. This includes iFixit's 54-bit driver kit with 54 standard, specialty, and security bits. You got Phillips, Pentalobe, Torx, Torx Security, Tri-Wing, Triangle Bit. Apparently, those are popular for McDonald's toys. I don't know if you have to repair much of those anymore, Josh. You've got swivel top, precision screwdriver, flex extension for hard-to-reach screws as well. That can be quite handy. It also comes with an ESD-safe precision set of tweezers for delicate manipulation, the watches and clocks, anti-static wrist straps. You have a nylon spudger, metal spudgers, plastic opening tools for prying, scraping. It also comes with a lightweight, compact, durable tool roll, which keeps everything organized, and it allows you to kind of wrap it up, throw it in a drawer until you need it the next time. And it's also easy to carry around that way and take with you if you've got to go to your friend's house or go to your mom's house and fix something that fell apart or broke for them. It's only $64.95, and it is apparently backed by a lifetime warranty. Hobbyists and home DIY fixers also use the ProTech Toolkit for doorknobs, eyeglasses, cabinet doors, sink fixtures, a whole bunch of other stuff like that. If you're looking for a great addition to a hobbyist tool chest, this is the one for you. You were going to say something, Josh?
Can it fix my broken relationship with my parents?
I think the spudger will be good for that, and maybe the scraping tool. If you apply them correctly, it does not have a shovel. It has basically it looks like a guitar pick in it. So that's like a tiny shovel.
Yeah, it'll take a while to dig, but it'll work. Hey, you saw the Shawshank Redemption, so you know.
Hey, if you got nothing but time, right?
Time.
So with iFixit, you can fix it yourself. Visit iFixit.com/twit for free step-by-step guides. iFixit also sells every part and tool that you will need. Plus, if you enter the code Twitch, T-W-I-C-H, at checkout, you can save $10 off of any purchase of $50 or more. That is iFixit.com/twit and use the code Twitch to save $10 off your order of $50 or more. We thank iFixit for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. And I'm 100% sure you'll not be disappointed with their purchases from there. We have a lot of stuff from there, and we have fixed several components, several devices, wife's iPhones, nephew's iPods. A lot of stuff has been repaired using those guides. So kudos to them. Let's get into some emails. What do you say, Josh?
Let's get in some emails.
Good. What do you say, good. Ryan? It's good. Good that you just repeat exactly what I say. That way it actually helps the audience know what is coming up. We're going to get into emails now, which is
are we going to read emails?
It's like electronic mail. Instead of sending us a letter, you can send us a note through electronic mail. And the address is twitch@twit.tv, T-W-I-C-H. At twit.tv, and we go through those and we filter some out every week to answer on the show, like this one from Chris, who I thought was appropriate with Josh being on today, asking about AMD processors. He says, I really enjoy your show and the website. I've been a DIY user for many gaming PC builds, and it's time to do it again. The problem is that I'm an AMD fanboy. This time around, I know I'll stick to their graphics cards, but the Intel dark side is whispering. Please talk me out from the shadow. Why should I stick with an AMD board and processor, and what's the best available today? This rig is strictly used for gaming. His current setup, in short, is an FX4170, which is a Zambezi quad-core. And then he's got a 240 gig SSD, Sapphire 7950, and a Crosshair 5 Formula motherboard. So what do you say, Josh? Should he stick with it?
The Crosshair 5 is a really nice motherboard. I mean, if wait until an 8350 is on sale and just flash your BIOS and pop that in, that would be a nice upgrade. You'll get double the cores. You'll get better power efficiency than your old Zambezi-based quad. It's going to have the same amount of cache, but a slightly higher IPC, and certainly, what does it run, 4.0 to 4.2 gigahertz? So you're going to be gaining performance significantly overall from your 4170.
So your recommendation or reasoning for why he should stick with AMD is like, well, you've already got a really good motherboard. There's no point in wasting that. Just upgrade the processor. How much is an 8350 even really going for these days? It's like,
typically they're on sale for $179. Sometimes I think last week Newegg had them for $159, which is actually kind of a smoking deal. I mean, $40 off usual price.
Yeah.
So I think that would be a solid upgrade.
What do you think about 9590?
That's still around $300.
I don't even
really
know if that supports it. It's like 370.
Yeah, it does not have the BIOS update that supports it. So I don't believe the 9590 and the 9370. I think those are the correct numbers. They are not officially supported by that board, because I don't think they've actually updated the BIOS on the Formula since last year. I know that the Formula Z is kind of the premier board for the 9000 series. But again, that's a year newer than just the Crosshair 5 Formula. I mean, you can try it out. It's kind of a crapshoot. I mean, it might work.
That's what everybody wants to hear. So the 4170 is quad-core, essentially at the same clock speeds as the 8350, maybe 100 megahertz difference there, but you're doubling your core count.
Correct. Right?
So and you would see a performance difference there for sure.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Especially in games like Battlefield 4, I mean, which will actually utilize those extra cores.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you happen to go multi-GPU, the additional cores might be beneficial as well. So that's your advice there. If you're looking for an excuse to stick with AMD instead of Intel, I don't think you need an excuse necessarily, but you already have a really good motherboard, and that's saving you money as well, right? So upgrade that processor and then upgrade that GPU. Add some extra memory in there. Yeah, I mean, you save money on the motherboard. You save money on the motherboard. Go ahead and get a 290X. You deserve
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Really, you do. Yeah. We got an email from Ronald about USB 3.0 speeds. He says, I'm trying to copy some video files from my Drobo 5N via Ethernet to an external Western Digital hard drive using USB 3 on the PC and on the drive. The drive is a 4 terabyte MyBook. I'm getting 11 to 12 megabytes per second transfer speeds. I don't expect the full 625 megabytes per second that USB 3.0 offers. It's good because you definitely won't get it. Yeah. But this is way too slow. I even connected the drive to a USB 2.0 port and still got the same speeds. What's the problem? Can you please explain this? Any ideas on this? I will say, first off, the Drobo 5N, if it is the model that I think it is, let me see.
Did Alan have some problems with that one where it was slow? Oh, you have had problems.
We had one of these for a while, and it claims to have gigabit Ethernet, but we were never able to get above like 25 to 30 megabytes per second transfer in and out of it. And my guess was that it was because the Drobo 5 had a USB 2 connection, and they were just using like a USB to Ethernet adapter on it, like internally, and that's how it became a network attached device as opposed to a USB attached device. I was never 100% sure on that, but that was always my guess. Even then, the 11 to 12 megabytes per second is really, really slow. I would say, I would say take the 5N out of the equation. Right, transfer files from your PC to the MyBook, the Western Digital MyBook. It's a USB 3 device, right? So if you're still seeing that same 11 to 12, then you know the problem has nothing to do with the Drobo and it's all on your system. It's possible that you didn't install USB 3.0 drivers, I guess, or maybe it's not enabled in the BIOS. Maybe you have legacy mode enabled on all those or something like that. It doesn't mention what particular board he's using, so it's hard for me to know for sure. Any other ideas?
The other is just, you know, create some space on your regular machine and then just kind of benchmark downloading directly to one of your internal drives from the Drobo. You know, find out where the leak is.
Yeah, he mentions video files because my first guess was if he's moving a ton of small files over USB, it will slow down your transfer rate dramatically.
Really slow.
Right. So if you want to test it, get like a single, like 2 gigabyte file or something and transfer it between the two. You know, try to copy it to the My Pro and then try to copy it back and see what your speeds are there and then kind of guess from that direction forward. And I would take the 5N out of it, but
yeah,
hopefully it's not slowing it down that much. An email from Ezekiel. It's less of a question, more of maybe an interesting point. I don't know if you've ever seen anything like this before, Josh. He says, last week someone wrote in wondering how to install Windows without an optical drive. Someone mentioned the Windows USB installer tool. But that tool and the CD installs only make BIOS MBR installs, master boot record. As you know, BIOS installs work on UEFI machines because there is a BIOS emulation layer. But if someone wants to perform a UEFI install to enable proper GPT support and booting on drives larger than 2 terabyte or have more than 4 primary partitions, they cannot use the USB installer tool. To make a UEFI capable Windows install, they need to make a 32 gig or smaller FAT32 partition on a thumb drive and use a utility like 7-zip to copy the files from inside the ISO straight onto the partition. No special tool needed. After that, they need to UEFI boot into the thumb drive, and when allowed to create its own partition. Windows will convert the drive to GPT and create its partitions that way. An easy way to spot that the Windows installer is in UEFI mode is if it creates 3 to 4 partitions instead of the 2 it makes for BIOS MBR installs. Yeah. It's interesting. I didn't know any of this.
I've got a USB install stick over there that I made through the Microsoft. Now, the Microsoft tool, it had a couple of times where it just puked. I could never get it to work. So I erased the USB drive a couple of times, reformatted it, and it finally worked, and I was able to install Win 8.1 in UEFI boot mode without a problem. So I don't know where the weakness is. It could just be, you know, there are a lot of pretty, USB drives are becoming commodity items.
I
think that their quality certainly has gone downhill quite a bit. And I have used this on several sticks, and I've had several of those sticks all just fail. And until I go and rewrite them a couple of times, then it finally just magically starts working. So, yeah, I know for a fact, the stick that I've got out there on the graphics workstation that I had redone for Windows 8.1, it definitely boots to UEFI. So,
yeah. I think it, especially if you have a single drive that you're installing it to, this may be not be an issue if you're not worried about how many partitions you have on that drive. If it's just a single letter, it may not be a problem. But interesting note nonetheless. I will say in the USB drive thing, I got a new one in that's, I think it's under embargo for a little bit longer, so I won't mention which one it is or whatever, but it's a 128 gig USB 3 drive that we were able to see over 450 megabytes per second read speeds on.
That's sick.
Yeah, on a USB on a thumb drive, like one that can almost fit on a keychain. It's fairly small. It's much smaller than the other super fast ones I've seen before. But that'll be interesting to talk about next week, I think. Here's an email from David about a fire in his PC. So this should be interesting. It says, hi, Patrick and Ryan, but I'll say hi, Josh and Ryan. I had an electrical fire in my 6-year-old home theater PC last Sunday night. I powered it up after being off for 2 weeks. Within half an hour, I started smelling smoke and thought at first it was a neighbor's lighting fireworks off. I then figured out it was my PC burning. I powered it off and disconnected all cables and removed the PC from my living room to front porch. Good move. I didn't know until removing the side panel that the DVD ROM was actually burning. I didn't have an extinguisher, but ended up using a water spray bottle to put it out. My question, I was hoping you could answer, did I just have bad luck with my 6-year-old DVD burner, or might have my 7-year-old Seasonic 430-watt power supply arced and caused the electrical short? He lists the specs there. He also says, I had the DVD burner connected with a PATA to SATA power converter that did burn like a candle wick when I examined the damage. Any reply would be appreciated.
Yeah, if you got a 7-year-old power supply, you're probably going to get some surging in there. And if you got a DVD drive that is that old as well, capacitors are going to be drying out. And if you get a surge, you could potentially just, you know, see components burst into flame. I don't know.
I don't know how to tell which way the surge happened, though, from the power supply out or from the DVD drive back, really. Unless there's some forensics you can look at in the burning carcass of your machine that maybe gives you, interest.
Take apart the DVD drive and see what components burst into flame. I think it's probably a combination of just bad luck and old hardware, and you probably had a brownout or a power surge, and the Seasonic did not handle it as well as it probably would have 5 years ago, and it just burst into flames.
I would probably recommend not using any of the components in that system again.
Yeah.
Anything, because the power supply was touching everything, if it was the power supply's fault. I mean, it's a little bit of an older machine. It's a Foxconn G31 motherboard with an Intel E8400. Obviously, it's disappointing because it was perfectly good functioning hardware before. Obviously, you've got 3 different hard drives there or 4 different hard drives. Hopefully, you'll be able to get the data off of them. I would, you know, maybe have a friend that has a different computer. If you have a different computer, hook up these hard drives individually. Hopefully those two WD Red 3 terabytes were in like a RAID 1 array, so you can read them as a single drive. Try to get all the data off of them just in case there was any residual damage to them, right? Mm-hmm. And copy them to a different drive, a different external drive someplace. Make sure you save all of your data as soon as you can. But that is unfortunate, unfortunate news.
That's bad luck.
Let's do one last email. This comes in from Joseph about his first PC and how he wants it to be a Steam machine. He says, it's finally time for me to build my own gaming PC. I've been watching Twitch for a year or so, and I think I'm ready to pick out some parts. However, I'm 100% noob when it comes to building a PC, and I figured I'd narrow down my suggestions. His budget is $700 to $1,000, leaning towards the low end if possible. This will be a Steam machine only. It will be plugged into my TV directly, will boot into Steam Big Picture mode, and not be used for anything other than controller-style gaming. I like to play modern games in Ultra at 720p. Any particular suggestions for my case? Excuse me. If all else fails, I'm just going to buy an Alienware Steam machine or its competitor when it launches around holiday season. Hopefully around holiday season, actually. What do you think about that? If you have a budget of $700 to $1,000, if your target is 720p, I'm not exactly sure. Maybe it's a 720p monitor or TV. You should definitely be able to build a pretty awesome gaming machine for $700.
Yeah, I wouldn't use anything less than an R9 270X or, I guess, on the NVIDIA side, a GTX 760. I think that those are probably some of the more future-proof products out there, and they're relatively inexpensive. They'll probably still be one of the most expensive parts of the entire machine. But when you're dealing with $700 to $1,000, it's not really saying a whole lot.
No.
I know that you guys did some budget builds. I did some budget builds. But go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say, you know, we obviously at PC Perspective, there's a leaderboard. If you go to pcpro.com/leaderboard, you can see four systems that we spec out at different price points, you know, from budget to mid-range to high-end all the way up to like super-duper expensive Dream systems. We have one at $900 and we have one at $462. So if you look at the $900 mid-range machine, it gives you an idea of kind of what components we're looking at there. And this would be, this does have a GTX 760 in it. It has a Haswell processor, and it's got 8 gigs of memory, right? And it's even got a 250 gig SSD. So you'd have all the components for a really killer gaming system there. The only thing I would question about your choice to build your first PC is to go with a Steam machine versus a Windows machine. The problem is that the Steam machine, the Linux-based Steam game library, is very limited still. And I would like your first gaming PC experience to be a positive one, right? So where you have access to the most possible titles. If you build a Windows machine, you can still hook it up to your TV. You can still use a controller to game, and you can still have it auto load into big picture mode. Like, you know, I'm almost 100% sure you can do that, right? Or you can have a shortcut on your desktop that runs Steam into big picture mode. I know it's very easy to get into big picture mode while running Windows on Steam, and you'll have access to a much larger game library. And maybe this is just like from my own experiences, but I think you'll have better chances, since it is your first machine, figuring out hardware, figuring out drivers, figuring out configuration of this stuff will be easier on Windows. You'll be able to find more support for it throughout the interwebs on Windows. Do you agree, disagree? Do you think it's okay to maybe start with like a Steam machine?
I think, you know, I'm not saying no, but you're going to be in for a rougher ride just because you guys installed the Steam beta OS and you guys had some issues, and you're, you know, fairly knowledgeable individuals.
Yeah, I like to think myself as,
Yeah. And so you'll be running into some issues when you do this. I mean, it's getting better, obviously, and they're trying to make it a lot more user-friendly. But Linux in general, is it's a little bit more hands-on. You've got to be a little bit more knowledgeable to get things to run really well. I mean, our friend like Vin Stone at Linux Gaming, weekly? LG? I can't remember.
Yeah.
He'll kill me for saying that, but he's in Georgia, so he's got to travel a ways. But if you watch any of his videos about when he plays games or he imports a Windows game to Linux and what he has to do to get it to working, I mean, it's kind of phenomenal what he's able to do. But you just sit there and you listen and you watch and you try to take notes and you're like, screw this. How did you figure this out in the first place? This is like the world's most complex puzzle box, but that's just kind of the territory that you're going into when going into this type of gaming.
Yeah. I'm super glad you want to build a PC. That's what we're all about here. It's what we're promoting. It's what we're hoping you find the joy in and show you the joy in doing it. And I have nothing against Steam Machine either. Like, we build it, I see the benefit of it in certain cases, but I almost would always recommend it be like a dual boot situation or a secondary machine that you still have access to Windows, because there's still a ton of games that aren't going to be available on Linux that are going to be available on Windows. And I want you to have access to that whole library. So good luck with that, Joseph. Let us know if you have any updates or more questions. And again, if you have questions, send them in to Twitch at twit.tv, T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv. You can find Josh and I and all of our amazing work on PC Perspective. That's at pcper.com. I am on Twitter at Ryan Shrout. Josh, you are on Twitter
at Josh D. Walrath.
Josh D. Walrath. And again, final reminder, if you are going to be in the Dallas area for QuakeCon, July 17th to the 20th, Josh and I will be there along with Alan and Ken and Matt. Stop by and see us. We'll actually be recording a podcast Wednesday night in the Emerald Room at the Hilton Anatole as well.
Bring beer.
So stop by. Stop by, bring some beer. I don't, you know, whatever. That's cool. We'll hang out afterwards as well. And I think it'll be a lot of fun. Looking forward to it. Not looking forward to the travel to get there, but looking forward.
Don't you have an interesting dog leg?
I do. I go to San Francisco for like 13 hours, and then I go to Dallas.
That's awesome. So you're going to feel so good.
It's going to be amazing. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be awesome. Well, Josh, thank you again for filling in for Patrick. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's fine. find all of our back episodes at twit.tv/twitch, and you can find links to all the RSS feeds for audio and video for you to subscribe to our show. Thank you, everybody, for watching. We'll see you next time on Twitch.